afternoon, and welcome to Haydn Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Uta Tsan, who is a violin maker based in the Twin Cities, whose works are for sale across the United States. And we'll be talking about yoga and her recent interest in paper crafts. It is recent, right?
No, actually, it's been going on for a while, okay. But it's had a whole boost recently.
Okay, sorry. So you're just overall paper craft enthusiasm.
Yes.
Okay. Welcome, Uta. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So you are my cello doctor, essentially. I go to you. I trust you with my life, or with my cello's life, that is. And I just love your work. Thank you so much for always being there and taking care of any crisis I might have. You always seem to calm me down.
Those terrible nicks that you make while you're
playing. Oh, I know. I'm sorry. Sorry about that. I try, but...
Yeah, I know. You're a very passionate musician, so things happen.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, so I'm curious, what is your most insane performance story?
So my most insane performance story, I had to dig through quite a few insane performance stories, but it was this. I lived in Hong Kong in the 1990s, and I was doing a lot of freelance playing then. And so, of course, in 1997, Hong Kong was handed back from English government to the Chinese government. And so there were a lot of events to commemorate that. Mm-hmm. So a lot of celebrations, there were some farewell parties, there were some yay, we're going back to China parties. And so I was really busy with all of that. And in the middle of that, I got a call from a lady who said, yes, hi, I got your number from somebody. And I was wondering if you could perform at my End of Empire coffee morning.
Whoa.
And so I thought, now here's an interesting concept.
Yeah.
Nothing to commemorate the end of an empire like a coffee morning. And I said, yes, of course. And and I, at the time I was playing in this trio in one of the big fancy hotels, you know, we had a regular gig there and I thought, well, we could maybe come with a trio. But she was quite adamant that she didn't have enough space for three people. Mm. And she wanted a duet. She wanted a flute and cello duet.
Okay.
So I said, okay, I think I can do that. And I called all the flautists I knew. And they all had daytime jobs where they couldn't take the morning off. And so eventually, you know, I went second layer. I asked them if they knew somebody. And so eventually somebody put me in touch with somebody who put me in touch with somebody. And this woman said she could do it.
Yeah.
And then I hustled to try and get some music together because I didn't have any duet stuff for flute and cello. And she said she had a couple pieces. And so, but you know, now we're like a couple of days before the event and there was no time to get together and play through any of it beforehand.
Okay.
And we thought, okay, that's fine because the ladies will be milling about and drinking coffee and chatting and we'll be doing this pleasant little background music.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, we got there to find that there were rows of seats neatly arrayed front of two music stands and it was going to be a sit-down performance and we were going to be playing together for the first time and sight-reading program of music.
Oh, no, no. How long was the program?
I can't remember. It was maybe 45 minutes or something
Still,
like that.
Okay, well, still, it's too long.
Yeah. It was quite nerve-wracking. Well, we got through it without terrible problems, and the ladies were charmed, and they asked us to stay for coffee afterwards, and they were paying us really well, I remember that. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't just want to run off and say, sorry, we're busy or whatever. So we stuck around, and there was this one woman who was just so fascinated with the whole thing.
Okay.
And she kept asking these very probing questions, and she'd be like, so have you known each other a really long time then?
Oh,
and
no.
I said, well, no, not really. And you must be, you must have been playing together a whole lot. Right? And we said, well, no, not no. Really well. How often have you practiced to make that? And so we eventually shamefaced, we had to admit to how mercenary we were and that we had really just met that morning. And she said, but that's extraordinary. Yeah. And we said, well, what's extraordinary? And she said, you don't know each other. You just played together for the first time, but you had the same music on your music stands.
Uh-oh.
And it was one of those moments where we just studiously had to avoid looking at each other because it was like there was no way we could have been polite.
Right.
If we had, you know, caught each other's eye. And but I mean, afterwards, I was thinking, well, good for her. She was fascinated and she was trying to find out. Right.
Yeah.
But it was just the whole thing. I mean, I shudder in retrospect.
Yeah, it's so funny. And it's just funny, like, how at different degrees I've been caught in a similar situation of trying to put a team together really quickly, learn some music or sight read on the spot, and then suddenly it's way more of an intense performance experience than it was intended or thought.
Yes.
And then also the reception of someone saying, like, oh, it's, like, incredible, like, all this. And it's just like, wait, what? How did we get away with this? Yeah.
Yes.
So. Oh, that's highly entertaining. Thanks for sharing that story.
Sure.
Are you ready for some Spitfire questions?
Sure.
Okay. Mahler or Bruckner?
Oh, my God. Mahler, I think I have to admit I'm not super familiar with either of them.
Oh, okay. Debussy or Ravel?
Oof, that's just mean. Ravel.
Sorry, I know. Cats or dogs?
Cats.
Appetizer or dessert?
Dessert.
Okay. Sparkling or still water?
Still.
Fan favorite question, alternate universe musical instrument?
Percussion.
Oh, specifically anything within the
marimba.
Family? Oh, marimba. Okay.
Yes.
Is that
actually any kind of percussion, I have to say. Yes. Yeah. I remember this rock concert that I went to way back in the 80s. I was a student. We went to the big city, Nottingham, at the time, and there was this all-woman band, and they had this percussionist who was, like, so into it, and she was so passionate, and it was like, I want to be that person in my next life. Yeah. But then I'm totally in love with the sound of the marimba, so.
I was actually curious. I mean, this sounds silly, because I feel like I know the answer, but can you make a marimba? Is that something that's in your wheelhouse?
Yeah, I have made a xylophone, actually. Oh. All wooden xylophone. And so it's really not so different, except you have to make those tubes and presumably tune the tubes, which is, that's something I can totally do, yeah.
The tubes are always metal, right? I mean, there's never another material.
Well, you know, I mean, this is something that came up in my research when I was making the xylophone. People make them out of all sorts of things, whatever they happen to have at hand.
Sure.
So, you know, there are all sorts of YouTube tutorials out there on how to make these things. And I mean, I saw people using PVC pipes and stuff.
I think it's
because it's easier, of course, to work with and easier to get a hold of, and they will still have some sort of a resonance.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Okay. Maybe I'll commission a marimba from you.
It'll probably cost about as much as a cello because it'll take so long to figure it all out.
That's true. Fair enough. Okay. I'll save up. Okay. Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Pandemic guilty pleasure?
Oh, way too much social media.
Okay. Just news in general or just catching up with people?
A lot of doom scrolling, but some of it is actually, you know, I found Instagram to be sort of a respite from everything because for some reason the things that show up on my feed are all about art or beautiful nature pictures and...
You have
and
a nice so algorithm I like going
that.
On then.
Yeah. And I try to keep it that way too. I try to not interact with anything other than that.
Too commercial. So that,
to kind of keep it nice and pristine. And so that's my haven.
That sounds like a life goal to have, actually.
Yes.
Keep your algorithm very crystal clear. And
yes.
Clean.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Favorite professor shout out?
Oh, wow. It would have to be, well, it's kind of a toss-up. I had one favorite violin-making teacher because he was very hands-on and very kind of down-to-earth, but also had great communication skills and was not sexist, which was actually kind of a big deal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so his name was Pat Jowett. I really liked him a lot as a teacher. Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
I think he had four daughters. That probably helped.
That helps, yeah.
Yes.
Most inspired musical hero of any genre?
Emmanuel Feuermann. The cellist. Sadly, he didn't leave very many recordings and he died young, but what he left behind is unbelievably musical and so moving and beautiful.
Oh, yeah, I'm there with you, of course.
Yeah.
Most transformative performance experience?
It's kind of hard. I mean, when you get older, there's been so many. I would say the one that's recently I got to see the Danish string quartet play their Beethoven cycle. I didn't see all of their performances. I think I saw three. But it was really, I mean, I just really felt like they had taken me on this very intense journey. But all the things, like all the feelings, all the grandest and then the most humble and the most tender and the most bombastic. I mean, it was all there and it was... Yeah. It was really like they took you through the ringer and you came out a different person afterwards. It was amazing.
Wow. That's awesome. Yeah. That was with the really Schubert amazing. Club, right? In town?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And it was so amazing also because, you know, I had first bought those tickets 2 years ago and then waited for 2 years to go to that concert. And so it was the first actual concert that I heard post-pandemic.
Life.
And so, yeah. 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 So it
totally
was
worth
really...
the wait then.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Desert island piece of any genre?
Oof. I really like the Brazilian musician Caetano Veloso. It would probably be one of his records.
Okay. I'm not really familiar. Is there like an album or a specific song?
I think my favorite album is Circulado Vivo. It's probably, I'm pronouncing it completely wrong because I don't speak Portuguese, but yeah. Sure.
Okay. But something to
it's
look
really
for.
Beautiful. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, you finished the Spitfire questions. Congratulations.
Oh, wow.
Unscathed, I think.
Yeah, that was not so painful.
Okay.
It's a very quiet triangle.
Well, if I do it too loud, then like the...
Yeah, my head will explode. Sure.
We don't want that. No,
not at the exploding head.
I'm like wondering, is there like any other little like instrument you can make for me to just put on? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I share this studio with a bow maker. I don't know if you've ever seen him here because mm-hmm. he hasn't been around a lot, but mm-hmm. we do these talks together for schools and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I used to always make a violin out of a cardboard box it was an interactive thing. Like, here's a cardboard box. How do we turn this into a violin kind of thing?
Okay.
And then the students would say, okay, now it needs, you know, it needs strings, but it needs something to tune them with. It needs a bridge. And of course, it would kind of sort of sound in a way.
It makes a vibration of some sort. Yeah.
Yes, it makes a vibration of some sort. So it's actually pretty easy to make a musical instrument.
Oh, wow. I had no idea. I have all these Amazon boxes.
Oh, there you go.
Next time. Okay.
Cellos. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Uta, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you... Sure. Cello was your first instrument, I'm assuming?
No, actually, okay. It was not. I come from a musical family. My mother was a really good pianist, and she had hoped to be a professional pianist. But then, you know, life intervened. She grew up in the 30s and 40s.
Oh, wow.
And so she actually was displaced from her home, and so then couldn't take the piano with her, obviously. And
right.
So that was all sort of put on hold. But she continued to play throughout her life, and she was really good and very musical, and it was really important to her that we all learned musical instruments and that we had those opportunities that she didn't get to have. So she started me out on like early music classes when I was four, and I think I maybe went a couple of times a week for a year or two. And so we actually started out on xylophone, and then they had us play little keyboards, and of course we sang and played all sorts of musical games and stuff. And then I wanted to learn piano. I think I started when I was six. It was a bit unfortunate because my piano teacher was somebody who was extremely overbearing, and she had really different ideas about what she wanted me to do from what I wanted to do. And I was this shy little child who never spoke. And so I felt just steamrolled into things. But I have two older sisters, and they joined the youth orchestra at some point.
Okay.
And actually were quite strategic about it. My oldest sister was like, I want to be in youth orchestra. I only play piano. I need to play a different instrument. I'm going to play whatever gets me in there fastest.
Okay.
So she picked bass.
Oh.
Because there were never enough bass players, and they would take somebody who had just a year of bass playing experience. And so that's what she did.
And the parts are probably a little bit more bass liney in some ways.
Yeah.
You can get away a little bit at the beginning.
Right. Exactly. And so she did that. And I had the other older sister played violin and viola, and she got in on the viola ticket because they needed violas.
Of course.
And I thought, you know, they and their friends were the coolest people to ever walk the earth, and mm-hmm. I wanted into the youth orchestra too. And so I knew I couldn't play a wind instrument because really I kind of just about pass out every time I play a recorder or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I had to be strings because my parents weren't going to have another really loud instrument. Like, it wasn't going to be percussion or something. Mm-hmm. So then I didn't want to play the same instrument they were playing, and so it had to be cello.
Okay.
So that's how I picked the cello. It's kind of quite mundane, sadly.
No. Well, I mean, clearly the best instrument out of all. I'm just kidding.
Of course. And I'm so lucky I picked it and so grateful. Yes.
Yeah. So then you joined the youth orchestra, and when did you decide that cello was kind of a ticket somewhere in your life?
Well, actually, I originally thought I wanted to be a professional musician, but I had terrible performance anxiety, and I didn't realize that, you know, teaching people how to get over it is part of the whole, or how to live with it is part of the whole, like, studying music business.
Right.
I just didn't realize it, and I didn't get any sort of coaching on it or anything meaningful in that respect.
Okay.
And so I thought I was going to have to deal with that all by myself, and I didn't feel up to it.
Well, that's understandable.
But I knew I I wanted to do something that was related to music for sure. Mm-hmm. And I've always liked making things. And so then I just essentially ended up focusing on violin making, and I slid into actually performing music and playing semi-professionally quite by accident.
Okay.
It was when I was already living in Hong Kong and people kept asking me, oh, you should join this orchestra. So initially I played in this amateur orchestra, and then this woman from the amateur orchestra said, well, there's this other orchestra that's just started and you should join that orchestra. And I had no idea that she wasn't talking about another amateur orchestra, that these were like professional people.
I see.
And so I just sort of showed up and they said, yeah, that's great. And we're here's a check.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So I kind of thought, oh, maybe I'm not as crap as I thought I was going to be. And uh-huh. maybe this is actually fun. And mm-hmm. yeah. And off I went on my little performing thing.
Yeah. So that was all while you're in Hong Kong.
Yeah. That all started when I was in Hong Kong.
Okay. May I ask why you moved to Hong Kong?
I moved there for a job, actually. I first trained as a violin maker in England. I went to violin making school there.
Oh, okay.
And then had my first job there also for a few years. But I wanted to leave England because it was a very, well, no surprises here, it was very insular.
Yes. Yeah.
As it is an island.
Yes.
And everybody knew each other. The violin making field was very sort of, it felt a little bit like inbreeding. Like okay. everybody had learned from the same people, and there was a lot of sort of gossip and uh-huh. and that. And I didn't really like that very much. And so I was trying to find a job somewhere else. And of course, I had this idea of going back to Germany, but then I ran into the issue that I had trained in England, and on the continental Europe, they didn't really like people who hadn't trained in continental Europe.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It was kind of strange in those days. I think it's really changed a lot.
Okay.
But then it was this, well, we wouldn't know what we're getting into, and the English school hadn't been around for that long.
Okay.
And of course, the Germans, there was a German school, and the German violin makers really wanted to keep out any kind of outsiders.
Okay. Did you know this before you started the school in England?
I mean, I knew about the guild system in Germany and that they still had a kind of a stranglehold on everything.
Okay.
And that they were not, for the most part, nice cut people to be getting okay. along with, but I didn't realize it was going to be quite as tough. And so I looked for a job for quite a long time, and then somebody suggested, you know, they said, here's this job in Hong Kong and you might want to check that out. And I thought they were crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, the person who said that to me was sort of the god in the violin world at the time. And so I thought, well, if God tells me to go to Hong Kong,
I better go.
Yeah. So yeah, so I applied for this job in Hong Kong. It was in a higher end violin shop. It was completely nuts. But anyway, I stayed there for a couple of years, and then I quit that job because I couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And I just kind of thought, well, here I am living in this fantastic place. I had a little bit of money saved up, and I just thought I'll just sort of enjoy the place for a little while because, you know, people come here on vacation and I haven't really done any of that stuff.
And the food. But then,
the food is to die for.
Yeah.
But so many other things. I had this very idyllic life on a small island. There were no cars. There were no high rises. Everybody knew each other. It was just really an amazing, amazing place. And so then I kind of thought I'll just stay here for a couple of months and then I'll figure out what I'm going to do next. And then all this work started finding me. And so I ended up staying another 7 years. So
oh, wow.
It was a really great time.
So it's like people like me knocking at your door, be like, ooh,
yeah, exactly. And then because I started playing in these orchestras, then people would say, oh, you make... okay, so yeah, yes.
Natural customers, yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so.
And I think I had a bit of an advantage because I was European, and it's this thing of, you know, it had a lot of cachet.
Uh-huh.
If you had trained in Europe and, oh, it's like old world.
Sure.
Skill and all that kind of stuff. So that helped.
So it was even more like validating in some way.
Yeah. Yes, okay. In a way, yeah.
Okay. And so then you left Hong Kong to where next?
Well, so what happened was somebody called me out of the blue one day and said, I'm setting up a violin shop in Vancouver, Canada, and do you want to come and work for me? And I had this response again where I thought, Vancouver, that's crazy. I don't know anybody there. I want to move back to Europe if I'm moving anywhere. But I sort of said, well, I'll think about it, thinking there's no way in hell.
Mm-hmm.
And then I walked out the door, I ran into my best friend, I said, you'll never believe what just happened. This crazy person called me, they want me to come to Vancouver. And she said, oh, you should go, you would love Vancouver. So I thought, okay, I'll try. And I arranged to go on a maybe 2 or 3 months to just sort of see how it fit. And it turned out it didn't really fit all that well. The shop was not a good fit for me, and the person was not quite what they had said they were.
Oh,
and, but then while I was there, I thought I'll just travel around and visit all my friends that I have in the States, because when will I ever come here again? And so I visited people in Seattle and San Francisco, and I had some friends in the Midwest. And so, you know, I'd go and fly out for a weekend here and there.
Yeah.
And I really liked the West Coast. And I also was starting to hear that things were really getting interesting as far as instrument making and restoration here in the States. That mm-hmm. there was this exchange happening that in Europe, that wasn't a thing. Like, people guarded their skills very jealously. They weren't about sharing anything. Mm-hmm. And it was like, well, I learned this the hard way, and now I'm not going to tell anybody else. I mean, even the teachers at our school, some of them had this thing where you would ask them a question and they would be really coy about answering it or not want to answer it.
It's
or,
like the trade secret for them. That's, yeah. I mean, I know, I can see the both sides of it, but information sharing is always on the, anyway. Sorry.
The thing is, you can have the information, you still have to learn how to incorporate it into your work. And, you know, the skill is something that everybody has to work at for themselves. Mm-hmm. That's not something that can be imparted on another person.
Okay.
And I think that if you don't help each other out, I mean, the thing is, it's a two-way street.
Yeah.
It helps everybody to share that information, because then everybody has more information and more knowledge and more possibilities and opportunities.
Right.
And so I never quite understood this. So anyway, so I was beginning to hear that in America they were doing things differently. And so I thought, well, maybe I should look for a job in the States.
Okay.
And put that out there. And then Claire Givens actually contacted me and asked me, did I want to come and work for her?
Got you. Okay. So that's where Twin Cities came
from. So then I thought, this is so crazy. Why would I want to go to Minnesota? It's landlocked. It's cold. Yeah. I've been living in the subtropics for the last 9 years. But, you know, I did this whole trip of, like, applying for different jobs and different shops all over the place. And Claire's was the one that most sort of fit the bill of what I was looking for. And that it was a bigger shop. And there were people who had a lot of experience. And they were working on very nice instruments. And so that was not something that I saw a lot of in Hong Kong.
Uh-huh.
And so I was excited about that. And so I came out here to work for her initially. And I thought I probably would be there for a couple of years or three. Uh-huh. And then try and move out to the West Coast, because I really love the West Coast. But then I just kind of ended up staying here. It's been 22 years and counting.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
22 winters, right?
Yes, 22 winters. Oh, my goodness.
Well, I'm incredibly grateful that you stuck around.
Well, thank you, Patty. That's made it all worth it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I seriously, it's like I've been around the block when it comes to luthiers, and just really mm-hmm. admire what you care and also tolerating the little dings everywhere. So can I ask you just a little bit about what it's like to be a luthier? Outside of repairs and maintenance things that you do for me, for instance, on mm-hmm. my instrument, I mean, I'm assuming that most of your instruments are commission-based, or is there something that inspires you to create an instrument?
Ah, yeah. Okay, that's a good point. Actually, not most of the instruments I made are commission-based. It's fairly rare for me at this point to get a commission. It's great when it happens, I would say, but it's not that frequent. So most of the time, I make something just because I think, oh, well, I haven't made a cello for a few years.
Okay.
Let's make a cello. Or, for instance, every other year, there's this big viola festival that the American Viola Society puts on. And so I want to go to that. I want to have a booth at that. And so it's like, okay, how many violas do I have available right now for sale? Or maybe I should make a couple more so that I have like a number for people to try out. Mm-hmm. So it's usually kind of that thing that's exhibitions coming up. Well, I haven't shown a violin at this shop before, so maybe I'll make a violin for that.
Okay.
It's that kind of a thing. So there are a lot of events. The making side of things is pretty sort of event-based for me, and then I'm hoping that at the event either somebody will buy that instrument or an instrument dealer will come along and say, hey, can I sell this on consignment?
Consignment, right. Okay.
Yeah, consign it for you. Yes.
Yeah, I see. Okay. So when you're creating an instrument, I mean, you're just crafting it for yourself primarily, right? It's not for a purpose? Okay.
Right. Yeah. I have a certain sound in mind that I'm after, mm-hmm. and then I try to make an instrument that will more or less match that sound profile. Yes. Or, I mean, if I'm making violas, for instance, then you're very much like, okay, what size viola?
Right.
Because of course they have this wide range of different sizes. And, uh-huh. and you know, if I want to go to a viola event, I want to be sure that I've got all the different sizes covered.
Okay.
And so then go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm just getting excited. Okay. So when you go to a viola conference or whatever, do you bring multiple samples of of violas?
Yes. Yeah, no, so I would try to have different sizes so that people can try them out, you know, because you have violas of all sorts of different sizes and violists prefer different kinds of sounds too. Right. So there's some people who like a more bassy sound and then there are people who like a more violin-y sound. And mm-hmm. so, of course, with the smaller violas, you're more likely to get a somewhat more, yeah, trebly sound. And with the bigger violas, you tend to get a bit, you know, bigger bassy sound, but not necessarily just as simple as that, but more or less. So it's that, you know, you want to have a good balance of different sorts of timbre that people can, you know, relate to, because everybody's taste is so subjective. And then bowing styles and the different bows, different instruments work with different bows, and so it's really complex field.
I know. It's almost cruel that I'm just throwing out these questions with so little to. I know. I almost feel like I should make a completely separate episode just to talk about all of this, because I've had to learn this in the process of finding my instrument and finding my bow. So it's like, I know what you're talking about, but it is such a process, not just from my perspective as the buyer of an instrument, but also from what went into the instrument before or who had it before, et cetera, you know, all those layers. So I'll skip some of those more in-depth questions for now, but I'm curious, how many instruments have you ever made?
That's a little bit difficult to count because, I mean, I've made about 50 completely by myself, but then I've also done projects with other people.
Sure, collaboration.
And I'm also not counting the ones that I made when I was in school. So, you know, there's a bunch extra there. And of course, I was also teaching violin making for a few years at the college in Red Wing. And so I made a bunch of parts for instruments during that time because, you know, a student would not quite come to grips with it or mess up, or I had to just quickly finish something for them. So, I mean, the count is, it's somewhat amorphous, but by myself, I've made about 50.
Wow.
It's actually not that many for somebody who's had a long career like me, but I've also spent so many years working in repair and restoration and done so much, you know, spent a lot of time playing. So it does distract
from the production. Sorry.
It does distract a little bit, yes. And all that practice you have to do if you want to be a musician, it just eats into your time.
Yeah, definitely. Can you tell me a little bit about what it's like to train to be a luthier?
Yeah, there's essentially two different ways to go. One is you go to a school, and that's what I did. And then the other one is you apprentice with a person or with a number of people.
Okay.
That's become a little bit more unusual, I think, these days, but it still happens occasionally.
The apprenticeship is more unusual.
Yeah, the apprenticeship is a bit more unusual. And I think the reason for that is that it's actually quite expensive to have an apprentice. Like, I don't think I could do it if I wanted to train somebody, just because it's so much time. It takes so much time.
Uh-huh.
During which time you have to essentially breathe down somebody's neck. I mean, it depends on how what their background is and how gifted they are with woodwork and all that. But, you know, you have to really, really pay attention to an apprentice, especially through the process of the first instrument that they make.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, most people these days, I think, go to schools, and there's a number of violin making schools around. So the one I went to was in Newark in England, and it had been around for maybe 12 years or so when I first started there. Maybe not even that. I don't know. Not that long. It's a 3-year program, or it was when I was there. And at the time, there were 12 students in each year. And so the first year we each made 3 violins. And then the second year it was focused mostly on repair and restoration. And then we made a viola at some point. And in the third year, those people who wanted to made a cello. And then everybody tried to make as many instruments as they possibly could. And then there was our like final piece that was portfolio. Maybe. So the final instrument had to be made in maybe 4 weeks or so time period, and that was pretty strictly supervised because that's what we were going to be graded on.
Wow.
And so it was very, very hands-on. We had some sort of theory classes. We talked about acoustics a little bit, and we talked about music history and musical instrument history. We had lessons and all of those things, but it was mostly instrument making. Or actually, what was really great about Newark is that we did a lot of metalwork and wood, general woodwork lessons that was there for us to make our own tools. And so I didn't always love it, but I really appreciated it.
Sure.
Yeah.
How long does it normally take to make? If you're just committed to making a violin, does it take 4 weeks?
No, probably not now.
Yeah, because that to me sounded very quick.
Oh, no. I mean, if that's all I did, I would probably be able to make an instrument in 2 to 3 weeks, I would think.
Oh, wow.
A violin, not a cello.
No, cellos,
Too much wood. And I don't have any machines. I mean, I only have a drill press and a grinding wheel. And that's, so I cut everything out by hand. I do all the sawing and everything by hand. So it's a little bit, that slows you down a little bit. I still like it though. I think it's an important part of the process because you really get to know the wood really well if you do everything by hand.
Sure.
So you know what that particular piece of wood is like.
How it's behaving.
How it's behaving. And I don't think you could have that if you just everything by machine.
Yeah. Right. You mentioned earlier about sexism. Is that?
Yes.
So I'm curious as to why that was a thing.
Yeah. Why is it a thing? It's a good question. Why is sexism a thing anyway?
I mean, overall, but specifically in making instruments.
Yeah, I found it really surprising, actually, because I became interested in violin making because my oldest sister had two friends who, when they were 18, decided to go off to violin making school. And one of them was a girl and one of them was a boy. And so because one of them was a girl, I was like, okay, so
I can do this.
I can do this. Exactly. It was exactly that. I saw it modeled and I thought I can do it too. All the adult violin makers I knew were all men. But I kind of figured that was a generational thing. And in our generation, of course, now women do everything. And so I was sort of surprised when I arrived in violin making school. And in my class, only 1/3 of the students were women.
Wow.
And then one of them, I have to roll my eyes a little bit, one of them quit after the second year to get married. So that didn't really help the feminist cause. But I don't know. I mean, the thing is that there is quite a lot of sexism. I mean, the German violin making school, for a long time, they didn't want to take women. And then for a while, they wanted to take women because they figured there are too many violin makers and these girls will just get married and drop out of the workforce. So it's good if we take them, we train them.
Oh, wow.
And then they won't actually be competitors. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's this sort of weird thing. Some of our teachers at the school were really quite sexist. Like I had one teacher who was always making these remarks about women or trying to, you know, slyly put a hand somewhere that a hand shouldn't be.
Oh, dear. Or no, no.
I remember asking him a question about something once and he said, I'll answer that for you if you come to my workshop at home and sweep out the workshop for me.
Oh, what?
And yes. And I said, no, thanks. And he was quite offended and he came to me afterwards and said, you know, Uta, if there's something that you don't want to do or if somebody gives you an offer like that, next time you just say, I'll think about it.
He was really hurt.
He was really hurt that I didn't want to take him up on his offer of coming to his house by myself and sweeping out his workshop so that he would answer me a question, which is what he was paid to do.
Totally. No, you know?
I mean, there was stuff like that. And there was many, many other things that, I mean, at a recent VSA conference, the VSA is the Violin Society of America. And at a recent conference, a woman she asked all the other women to tell you the stories that they had. And I kind of thought, oh, I don't really have that many stories. Well, there's that one about that teacher. And then I sort of started thinking, oh, and then there was that one about, you know, being slapped on the butt with a violin by my boss. And then there was the one about somebody who I did an internship with giving me this long, long, uncomfortable hug and saying, oh, I finally got to squeeze your boobs. And I mean, it was just stuff like that. There was a lot of that. There was a lot of that stuff. I had a conversation with a maker who was sort of in a mentoring capacity the entire time. He never looked once at my face. He looked at my legs the whole time. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was just stuff like that. And it happened so many times. And I have to say, I haven't been to too many professional events where some untoward thing did not happen.
I knew it wasn't going to be good, but I did not know that it was that. I'm sorry that you had to experience so much of that.
Yeah, I mean, and I actually sort of got away lightly. There were women who had way, way worse stories.
Sure.
And it's that thing where, you know, you can't really out a lot of those people because they have so much power in our trade, you know. And it's so I think now the women have started talking to each other at least and saying
that's a start.
And there is a group on Facebook that's women in Luthery, and so they say, okay, what do you know about this person? Is that an okay person to work for? And, and that kind of thing. So it's beginning to get a little bit safer, I think.
More transparent, yeah.
Yes, and more transparent, yeah.
Gosh, wow. I don't know why I'm so surprised. I shouldn't be, I'm like, sorry. I'm processing what I just heard. Wow. Well, I mean, I hope that doesn't also, hearing these stories, I hope it doesn't, for a listener listening to this episode, not deter them away from the art of making instruments, though, you know?
Well, no. And I mean, it's not unique to instrument making.
Right.
But it's also not surprising that you're dealing with people who are still trying to perfect a craft which was at its height 350 years ago, right?
Sure.
So we're not exactly a forward-looking bunch. On the whole.
Fair enough, I guess. Yeah, but definitely though, I mean, like, I don't know, I chose a more or less modern instrument to perform on, and
yeah,
I think there's always a demand for it, or for instruments in general, and newer ones too, because the modern instruments I've played are almost more comfortable to play than any of the older ones I've ever played.
Well, that's actually a really good point that you're making,
yeah.
I mean, there's this veneration of the old for the sake of the old, and of course modern makers are trying to do away with it, but my point was more that, you know, here we are. We're constantly thinking, how would Strad have done this?
Right.
And how do we best reinterpret it reinvent, or, you know, how do we best represent this thing that he perfected, and while also trying to integrate modern tools, for instance, software and stuff like that. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that is the one modern thing that I do use.
Software?
Well, like Audacity and programs like that help me analyze sound, and there are also different kinds of acoustics type software that will give you different information. And so those kind of things definitely used, but we're still kind of looking to this ideal of an instrument that was first created several centuries ago. And so there is that sort of hearkening back to the past aspect to our trade. So it's not so surprising that some of the attitudes are also kind of medieval.
I mean, I guess thank you for sharing and being so open to sharing these experiences, because it will hopefully push the needle a little bit toward being more progressive. And
that would be great.
Yeah, you know, and forward thinking rather than backward thinking. I could continue to talk. Like, I have so many more questions, but but I feel like we should probably take a break at this point. Is that all right?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, all right. We'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So you were telling me that you have spent a quarter of a decade. No, I can't. Numbers.
A quarter century. Yes.
That's 25 years doing yoga.
Yeah, that's right. It's been one of these things. I had this idea about how I wanted to learn how to practice yoga a long time ago. And so, again, I was living in Hong Kong at the time, and various people would tell me about different kinds of yoga classes, and I would go and try it. And I was like, well, no, this is not what I'm looking for. So one of them was this, what they called Kundalini yoga. It made no sense to me. And it seemed to be a bit of a personality cult, actually.
Oh,
and
dear.
So I was a bit weary of that. Yeah. Wary, I should say, not weary. And then another one was, I don't know, some other thing that didn't make much sense. And then I had this friend who said, oh, there's this teacher that's coming to town, and she's an Iyengar teacher, and I knew nothing about what that meant, but she said, she's supposed to be really good, and I signed up, and you should sign up too. And this friend and I, we would do yoga. We had these videotapes, like actual VHS tapes. And it was mostly sort of fitness stuff, but then she had a couple of tapes of people doing yoga, and one of them, I remember the first one was Jane Fonda, actually.
Yes, wow,
that really dates me. And so Jane Fonda does yoga, and so we did this thing all the time, and we really liked it, and we thought it was going to be like that. Well, we showed up to this yoga workshop that this teacher was teaching from the United States, and it was like nothing we had ever done before, and it was so hard, and we had the wrong kind of mats, and we just clearly were totally out of our depth. And I'm sure that this poor teacher, she's like, who are these two dumbos who showed up here and thought they could take part? But she was very kind, and there was something about that class which just felt absolutely right for me. And so then I just sort of thought, okay, that's what I have to do. I have to look for another Iyengar yoga teacher. And there was this woman who taught, it was actually all kind of funny. She was also a belly dancing teacher, but she had studied Iyengar yoga, and so she taught that method, even though I don't think she was necessarily an accredited Iyengar teacher.
Okay.
But she taught out of this there was this big high rise, which was in mid-levels, which was sort of a nicer part of Hong Kong Island. And they had a billiard room and she taught in the billiard room. Oh. And so she would do her demonstrations on the billiard table. And the thing is that, you know, there was always a lot of construction going on in Hong Kong. And so we would try to do this thing of going inside and relaxing and doing these. And meanwhile, there's like a pile right next to us. So that was kind of crazy. But I got this idea of, okay, so this is, you know, it felt so great. And it just felt fantastic to, after the classes. I mean, the classes were so incredibly hard, but then after the classes, it was just the best thing ever. And so it was actually one of the things that, in a way, made moving easier for me. There was like a number of things that I thought, okay, when I move to Minneapolis, halfway around the world, to this completely new place, I know that I can look for an Iyengar yoga class.
Right.
And that will help me sort of find my feet. And
literally almost.
Really, really. Yep. So when I first moved to Minneapolis, I lived in Uptown and I would ride my bicycle to work at Claire's shop. And I rode down Lindale Avenue and I was going past this Iyengar Yoga Center there.
Uh-huh. Well,
and
perfect.
So, yep, yeah. Absolutely. I called them. They sort of said, well, how long have you been doing this? I said, well, a year and a half. And they said, okay, you come on Wednesday nights. Again, I was totally out of my depth in the Wednesday night class, but, you know, eventually sort of kind of caught up and it's just been this really amazing journey. I've traveled to India a couple of times to study at the Iyengar Institute there for a month each time. So I'm hoping to go back one of these days. But meanwhile, I mean, that's been the thing that's been really kind of amazing about the pandemic is that a lot of these teachers are now teaching Zoom classes. And so you don't actually have to travel to India. You can have your Indian teacher come right into your bedroom or wherever you happen to practice. So it's been really this amazing thing. And I was very lucky because the teacher I had here for many years before she retired, she didn't just want to teach the physical aspect of yoga, but she tried hard to kind of impart more of the philosophy to us and made us study the texts that go along with it. And so it's been this really comprehensive approach, which I like a lot.
Could you share some of that with us?
Oof. It's...
Maybe?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the Iyengars really base a lot of their system on the teachings of an Indian sage who lived about 2,500 years ago, I think, and he was called Patanjali, and he composed a text about yoga. So he was an expert in yoga, he was an expert in the Sanskrit language, and he was an expert in Ayurveda. And so he composed these essays about each of those subjects. And the one about yoga is essentially 196 verses, I think, and they're very dense. So because he had to be able to come up with a format that was, it was transmitted verbally from teacher to student. So the guru would teach the students these texts and then by repetition, they would learn these texts. It wasn't written down for a very long time. Right. And so then I guess about the first 500 years, this is what happened. And then after 500 years, there was another learned man who lived. His name was Vyasa and he started writing a commentary about this text to kind of make it a bit more accessible. Because a lot of it is extremely, I mean, you kind of look at these sentences and you think, okay, I know what each of these words mean, but I don't know what the combination of this. Yeah. I just like, what does that mean? And so for some of them, I still don't know what they mean. And some of them I've done enough reading and enough sort of sitting on them for years that it's become a little bit clearer. But it really, really helps to have, you know, somebody who takes you through that. So that's been one of the great things with the pandemic is that the teachers in India, one of the Mr. Iyengar's son, Prashant Iyengar, he has been doing a series of talks. And so I think he puts one out every week or every two a week or something like that. There's quite a few of them by now. And so, you know, he goes into it in depth and explains what all of these words and combinations of words mean. But it's been really quite the journey and learning a little bit of Sanskrit here and there, which is also really interesting. So, yeah.
I guess it struck a chord with me when you were saying about interpreting the essays. Mm-hmm. And how that's just so similar to music. Because if you look at a sheet of music, if you don't know the notation, it looks like dots and lines. But then once you learn a little bit, and then this idea of there's a measure in a string quartet, let's say, that you just don't understand what's going on. But then over time that you mature character with it or something, it reveals itself to you.
Yes. Yep.
And I really find that that's like such an interesting connect, or just one that I can really relate with.
Yes. And there's also this idea in yoga that I have learned a lot about how to approach music from how I approach yoga, actually.
Yeah.
Because I've learned to be a lot less focused on the end result and more on the process of,
right,
you know, I used to practice for, I'm going to practice for this performance. It has to be perfect by this time. And it puts so much pressure on, and it actually makes me practice in the wrong way. Yeah. Whereas if I think about it more in terms of, I will be living with this piece of music for a while, so I'll just work on this piece of music, mm-hmm, or let it work on me, whatever, whichever way around. So that's been one aspect where yoga has informed my approach to music. And then the other thing is that you can pare things down to ever finer units in a way. Like you can look at more and more subtle aspects of something, and also the space between things, like what happens between notes, what happens between measures. Right. I mean, those have all been things where I've thought, oh, wait, I can actually, that can go into my musical practice just as, mm-hmm, much as it can go into my yoga practice. Yeah.
I'm also even thinking that translates into making instruments too.
Oh, for sure.
If anything, I'd probably be even more straightforward like that.
Yeah, and making instruments, of course, it's hugely a process-based thing because you're just there with that thing for such a long time, really.
Yeah.
I mean, whereas a piece of music, if you're, you know, when you're performing it, it's over, right, in an hour or whatever, but
sure,
the instrument is not over.
Right.
And it's permanently stuck. It will live for a very, very long time in
that's
whatever
the
form you, yes, that's, yeah, the hope, yeah.
Right. Okay, so I'm intrigued by your travels to India.
Ah.
So is this like you totally just, it's like a retreat, you just go?
It's not exactly a retreat because you are living in a very busy, very loud Indian city.
Uh-huh.
The Yoga Institute, when it was first built, it was in this, like it was a suburb of Pune. And Pune is one of the fastest growing cities, if not the fastest growing city in India. It's one of the most sort of modern developed cities. But when this institute was first built, it was still pretty much the countryside there. And it was this lovely, you know, it was situated in this place called Model Colony, which was, you know, that's what it was imagined to be, this bucolic place, essentially. But now they're building skyscrapers everywhere. I mean, talk about pile drivers.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, pile driver hell. And so, you know, and there's no, like you find yourself an apartment and then it's, you know, usually within 5 to 10 minutes walk from the institute, but you're like right there. There's, you know, feral dogs, feral pigs,
monkeys,
you know,
not so much.
I haven't seen so many monkeys in the city, outside the city. Yes, but not in the city.
Yeah.
But, you know, lots of people everywhere. They're constantly repairing the pavements for some weird reason. And so the sidewalks are always uneven and being torn up, and there's potholes everywhere, and the traffic is crazy, and it's very, very loud because everybody's using their horn all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not a retreat exactly. But so you go and usually there's like a 2-hour class in the morning, and then there's a 3-hour practice session where you can be in the hall and do your own thing. And then the rest of the day is usually more or less free. Sometimes they have extra events where they have talks about the philosophy or about the Bhagavad Gita, something like that. But usually, yeah, the rest of the day is free. And it's a bit challenging because there aren't very many places to just sort of hang out comfortably.
Yeah.
Because it's hot, it's loud, it's quite polluted. So you don't really want to be outside too much.
Yeah.
And also there's this thing that it is a really different place for a woman to wander around by herself too. It's not,
of course,
super comfortable. Although Pune is better than most other places in India that I've been to.
Okay, so you've always gone by yourself when you've done these?
No, not exactly. I mean, I've
gone,
the first time I went with 3 other women from my class, so two of them and I were staying in an apartment together. And the second time I went by myself, but there were some people there that I already knew.
Mm-hmm.
So, because it's not a huge community again, the Iyengar yoga community is not enormous. But there's still, you know, you're not like wanting to be. I'm not somebody who wants to be with other people 24 hours a day, so.
Sure. I get that.
Yeah.
Okay, so this, I hope this doesn't sound like an insensitive question or anything, but I'm curious, what is the experience like traveling to a foreign city and country to practice the same yoga that you would be doing in your hometown?
You mean what draws me there?
Well, not necessarily. Sure, that can be, but there's gotta be something that you can't get here that you go elsewhere to find.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, our teacher always really encouraged us to go because she studied with the Iyengar family, especially Mr. Iyengar, who passed away a few years ago now, but she went there every year for, I don't know, 30 years or something like that, and would spend a month studying with them. So she said it's best to go to the source.
Sure.
And so it's just a different level of teaching, I would say. Okay. Because they are so steeped in the tradition and all those texts. I can read the Bhagavad Gita and say, okay, it means this and this and this and this and this, but they have grown up with it, and they have grown up living with those references. And for them, it's like, if you hand me a better known Bible passage, and I can probably talk about that for an hour or something, because mm-hmm. I've, you know, I was brought up Lutheran and I went to church as a kid and I listened to a lot of these things. And so deeply familiar and makes sense to me on many different levels. And so that's what that is for them.
Yeah.
And so they are able to just extemporaneously tell you many, many meaningful stories about any given sentence in any of those texts. And also their approach is, you know, it's kind of like a jazz musician in a way. If you know the elements that you're dealing with, then you can improvise. And again, they're so masterful in the subject that they're able to just be very free with it and teach in a way that maybe a lot of Western teachers wouldn't dare teach.
Okay. They go in a direction that, yeah, that stretches you, with the pun in, I suppose, intended. In a different way. Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's mostly internal stretches, though.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some external stretches that they also managed to make me do that I would never have been able to do here. But there is, you know, mostly it's the comprehension and the being with the thing that you're trying to be with.
That makes sense to me. Another one of my questions I wanted to ask you, in so many years of your practice, it's similar to my Spitfire question of asking you what your most transformative performance experience is, but what is there a moment that was like this light bulb of sorts that really has stuck with you?
Not as such, no. I mean, there have been a lot of moments where I thought, oh, now I've experienced something that I've never experienced before, but it would be really hard to put that in words.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah. Is there any particular thoughts that you wanted to share about your yoga practice experience?
Well, only that. I find it really strange that, and it's something I don't really understand. I don't really understand what drew me to it in the first place. And I don't really understand why all these other methods that I went through, I just knew that's not right. And then when I found the one that was right, it actually proved to be so right for me that I'm still doing it 25 years later.
Sure. You
know? It just amazes me that somehow there was some level at which I knew exactly what I was looking for, even though I had no idea what yoga even really was when I started. I guess the thing that I would say about that is a lesson that I need to relearn over and over again is to follow your own instincts, really. Because, you know, instincts can be powerful allies.
Yeah. Or a moral I also take from that is try to find what works for you before you toss it away or something like that.
Yeah.
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 Give it a few opportunities to reveal itself again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I always, I mentioned this to you earlier, but I'll just say to the audience that I love talking about yoga, and I know I've mentioned that it's been a popular topic on the podcast, but I find that topic, it's so connected to music, first of all, in so many of the pathways and things that we do in our practice as musicians, but also that there's so many different approaches and everyone comes to the same place from different areas. And so that's, I always learn something from that. So thank you again for sharing. Yeah.
Oh, of course.
Okay. So what about paper crafts?
Oh, so paper crafts. So I love everything to do with books. I love everything to do with storytelling. And I have always loved things that were small internal spaces. I've loved dollhouses. And I've always adored pop-up cards or pop-up books and stuff like that. So I love things that are sort of small and whimsical and three-dimensional and colorful. I love
and
doing
crafty.
Everything. And crafty, yes. And so I first started learning about book bookbinding, and that was quite serious bookbinding at the Minnesota Center for Book Arts. I went there 15, 20 years ago, something like that. They do these classes. And so I did a little bit of bookbinding. It was quite hard and I wasn't great at it, but you know, it was really fun. And then I've always liked just sort of playing around with paper. I think what I like about it is that the possibilities are endless. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I find often a little bit confining about instrument work is that there are some fairly strict parameters around what makes an acceptable violin or an acceptable cello, viola. You know, you can't even like paint them a different color, really. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to have a blue violin or green violin or super colorful. That's kind of frowned upon in the classical music world. And I experience that as pretty confining. And I have to say that, you know, a lot of my interests are these things that are so very, you have to be so particular and accurate. Like, I mean, yoga is one of those things that you can totally be a perfectionist about it. Instrument making, you can be a total perfectionist about it. And it's encouraged. But, you know, there's this side of me that just wants more freedom and wants to play and wants to let it all out. And so I found paper stuff to be just a great vehicle for that. So when the pandemic started, all of a sudden there was this explosion in online classes. And I have to say, I love that. And I found these different people who make different kinds of books and different sort of origami type folded structures. And I found a ink and pigment making class. And that kind of is useful for my work as well, because I can use the pigments. But it's just been so much fun to play around with all these different things and figure out different book structures of how to make stuff from plants and all this stuff. And it just sort of opens all these opportunities and possibilities that are so much fun.
Yeah.
So I just really like to play.
No, I'm like getting excited just like hearing you talk about it. Yeah. Okay. Where do I even start? I'm just going to focus on bookbinding for a second. So I'm sorry to do the numbers game again, but how many books have you even bound in general?
I have no idea. So, I mean, there's book binding, but there's also different ways of making books where you don't actually bind. Okay. So the book binding is the classic thing with a needle and thread, and there's different bindings, different methods of binding, and you stack all these different things on top of each other. And that's the thing that is actually really hard to do very well. It's one of those old and very exacting skills. But there are also people who make books in different ways where they maybe just take a piece of paper and fold it in so many different ways to make a book. And that kind of thing I find really fascinating and fun.
Yeah.
Or, you know, using glue, which is frowned upon in the, like, you know, higher levels of bookbinding stuff. But for people like me who just really want to do it for fun, it's fine. I'm good with glue. I have practice at glue. I can do glue. So So I mean, I don't know how many books I've made. I've made a bunch of little pop-up things and different forms of folded and a bunch of them. Many.
Okay. So are you making like notebooks for yourself or
No, it's usually quite different. So for instance, this was kind of a big project last year. One of my sisters had a big birthday and I thought I wanted to make something that sort of represented her life, different stages of her life. And so I made what is called a star book. And so you have essentially different layers of, it's a little bit hard to explain. It's almost like a theater set in a way.
Okay.
Where you have stuff that, you know, different, at different depths.
Yeah, I see your emotions. I totally visualize.
I'm trying to articulate how to say it. Yeah. So if you're in a theater and you have your theater set, then there's different layers of it in a way. And the star book is
from
like
background
that.
To foreground,
yes,
kind of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. From background to foreground. And so you can either, you know, glue different things in there, or you can cut the paper itself to make these different layers. And then you see through the different layers from the front to the back. And so what I did is I decided to dedicate one page to each decade of her life. And I incorporated photos. And it was sort of very much based on the different places she had lived. So I used, you know, bits of maps and train tickets and all these different symbols for all the movement that she had made in her life. Mm-hmm. That was one level of it. And just photos of the places where she had lived, the houses that she'd lived in, and so on and so forth. And then another level was all the things that she did during that time. And that was sort of the paper cutting element, where that is something I also really, really like. And I think it's because I'm quite good with knives and stuff. And so So there was this whole layer of the different things that she had done and experiences she had had. And then, you know, photos of her at these different stages in her life and bits of letters that her parents had written where they talked about her or talked about us kids and stuff like that. So It was all this sort of multi-layered thing. I mean, really literally multi-layered. And the thing is, when you open that book up, it actually looks like a star because it has these different, the different layers come together in the shape of a star, essentially.
Yeah.
So that was a big project, and it was very fun and very rewarding.
Yeah.
And took way longer than I thought, so it arrived months after her birthday.
As the best projects do, right?
Yeah.
You can't put time on creative, or I guess sometimes you, well, I don't know.
Sometimes you have to, but in this case, it just didn't work out.
Yeah. You're getting, I'm like, well, can I join you in this? Yeah. Can I learn? Can I be your apprentice in this? I don't know. But
I can send you some links.
Yeah, sure, please. Yeah, it sounds so intriguing. And like, I could see how that would be so therapeutic in a way.
Yes.
Just having such an overall goal with a really cool end result, but then working on little things along the way to build towards that goal.
Yes. Yeah. But then another project, other end of things, I have a young grandson. Uh-huh. And so what I made for him was I made him a treasure map. That was just a sort of a special book fold thing. Uh-huh. But it makes this map, and it had these different pop-up elements in it too. And then, you know, he had to read the clues and find the treasures everywhere. And he thinks, you know, I asked him once, like, what do you think is a treasure? What do you think is in the treasure box? And he said, toys. So he has this great idea of what a treasure is. So I was, you know, hiding toys in different places in the house, and he was using the treasure map to find them. And so that's,
fun.
That's just like little drawings and little pop-ups and stuff. It was much simpler, but it was really also fun and well received.
Yes. So it seems like a lot of the paper stuff you do is three-dimensional, right?
I like the three-dimensional stuff, yes.
I'm curious what happens if something goes wrong.
Oh, it does all the time. I mean, with the pop-ups, I've taken some classes and I've got this fantastic book. It's a pop-up book of pop-up structures. And so you can just look at how are they actually made? Like, how does that work? Like, and it gives you all the, like, cut this at this angle. And then it's more for people who want to do like an industrial production. But, you know, there are formulas and stuff like that. But sometimes you just kind of don't think and you cut the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. Oh, well. A lot of it can be fixed, though. I mean, that's the thing. Okay. The nice thing about paper, you can just
tape
it and put, or put another little strip of the same color paper behind and sort of feather it in and stuff. A lot of it is fixable.
And what kind of paper do you use for stuff like this?
All sorts of different papers. I mean, one thing that I do is whenever I have like some soap wrap or a box of something that I think, oh, this is really pretty, I keep it. So I use, I don't know, boxes that your face cream comes in. Soap wrappers are one thing, or anything. Like if I, you know, you get these cards sent about events all the time, like cultural events or whatever. And sometimes I really like the cards. And so I use the bits that don't have any writing on them. I mean, anything. But I also use just craft paper, origami paper.
So you don't need to like invest in like some real cardstock stuff.
Let me tell you, Patty, this is one of the big problems with this issue. Okay. Anytime I go into an art supply shop, I come out spending so much more money than I ever meant to. And then I have these fantastic papers, and usually I don't do anything with them for years.
Right.
Because it's so special and I don't want to waste it on an unworthy project.
Right.
And then at some point I'm always like, yeah, but I've had this for 10 years and
I bought done it. Anything.
Like, yeah. I might as well just do something. Yeah. It's a dangerous, dangerous hobby to have.
Slippery slope, yeah. Yes. I can see that quite... Is there a particular store in town that you...
Well, there's a number of stores. So I like to go to Art Materials on Lindale Avenue. They don't have quite as much as they used to have. They used to have an absolutely stunning collection of stuff. I think they had to pare it down a little bit because, pandemic and all the rest of it. But they still have good things. There's a place in my neighborhood on Lake Street and I can't remember what it's called now. It's something design something. Graphic design maybe, or I can't remember. It's close to the Mississippi River and it's on Lake Street, and they have a lot of tools and more basic papers. They don't have so much the decorative papers. Yeah. And then Paper Source sometimes has good stuff too.
Okay.
And of course the Minnesota Center for Book Arts. What a great place. What a great resource to have. They do fantastic classes. They do online classes still now, and they also do in-person classes. Dick Blick actually has a lot of stuff. Mostly you have to order it, but that's fine. Or if you take classes with somebody, then they often have recommendations where to get materials from.
Sure. This is just a quick question about tools. I mean, of course, scissors, but I mean, are there any other specific
kinds of scissors? Oh, again, so many different scissors. Yeah, I don't know about specific kinds of scissors. I mean, the instruction I had just to find scissors that are comfortable for you.
Okay.
Which, of course, that makes sense. I mean, I never do that much cutting with scissors. I find knives better to cut with because I'm so used to using knives.
Yeah.
Or scalpels. But, you know, a lot of paper cutters use scissors. And then you need a mat, a good, like, it's called a self-healing mat. So it's
you can cut it
and it doesn't actually have cuts in it. They're good for a long time. It's kind of, I don't know exactly what they're made of, but it's a little bit like a paper cutting equivalent of a dartboard, really. You know, you can throw darts in it and it doesn't.
I feel like I just need that for myself in general. Such a klutz, it's like,
And there's all sorts of little awls and other tools like that for punching. But mostly that. Mostly I use a knife, really.
Yeah. Can I ask you two final questions?
Yes.
What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
Ooh, don't give up so easily.
That's fair.
Yeah. Okay.
And as we enter a ever-evolving pandemic world, what elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue and what would you want to shed?
Well, the solitude is what I want to shed. I mean, there's been so much of it where I couldn't play music with other people.
Yeah.
And I found that really hard because playing music with other people, even if we're just getting together and sight reading stuff badly, it's just something that makes me so happy.
Yeah.
So I can't wait for a time when it's just completely straightforward to get together with people again and just be in a room and play music together. Well, I have to say that through the first year and a half of this, I was quite focused on practicing a lot. And I did quite a bit of research into women composers, and I played a bunch of music by female composers. And, you know, I found all this music and found out stuff about the women who composed it. And so that's something that I kind of think I'd like to keep going because it was just really interesting. And there's not enough music being performed, I think, by female composers. And there is so much stuff out there that's really interesting and worthy. And it's something that speaks to me, of course, because I'm a woman, and also because it's in a way more exciting to me to perform pieces that are not widely performed, because then I don't feel like now I have to somehow find the one original thing that nobody else has said about this before, an original approach or whatever, and I don't trust myself to find the original approach. Of course, also because I'm not like a fully professional player, not like you or, you know, somebody who plays in the Minnesota Orchestra or whatever. So it's more gratifying to approach pieces that are just so unknown that nobody's going to have a preconceived idea about what it should sound like.
Right.
And I feel like I can find my own voice then. I can find my own way of thinking about it. Like you have to, if there's no recording of something, you have to.
Well, you have to reimagine it, right? Or not even reimagine it. You have to imagine it.
Yes, and then, exactly.
Yeah, totally. I absolutely relate with that. Would you be willing to share your list?
Sure. This last round, we had the three pieces for cello and piano by Nadia Boulanger. Then there was Stacey Garup. I played a piece by a Chinese composer, which was called Memory, and the composer is called Chen Yi. Mm-hmm. It was originally written for violin, but she wrote a cello version for it too. It's solo piece. We played a couple of pieces that they were called Three Pieces in the Key of Tango by a woman named Adriana Figueroa Manas, I think, or Manas. And I'm missing one. I'll have to get back to you on that.
No, it's totally fine.
Yeah.
I think that what you're doing is absolutely what all of us should be. We all need to be trying to represent voices that have been not heard or, you know, stowed away, maybe is another way of putting it. So, yeah, I mean, and this is an opportunity, as I said, in a way, like it's an opportunity for us to share that knowledge. There's so much more music than what is in this quote unquote canon that we have.
Absolutely. Yep.
That is deserved, to play.
Yes, and also what I find interesting is that some of those pieces sort of straddle the line a little bit between classical music and other forms of music. And and I think classical musicians often have this one-track mind tunnel. In a way. Like this, tunnel vision, like this belongs in the tunnel and then everything outside of the boundaries are so much more fluid than that.
Yeah.
And so that's also something that interests me. I mean, I'm terrible at improvising. I couldn't ever do anything that involves improvising, but some of the music that we played had these more loose elements, and we've played a lot of music that has been inspired by folk music too. Mm-hmm. And so it interests me that there are these large gray areas which are often sort of ignored by the classical canon, as it were.
Yeah. Okay. Are there any platforms or websites for our listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects?
Sure. I have a website that's utezahnviolinmaker.com. I'm also on Instagram under my name, Ute Zahn, where I post pictures of my work fairly frequently. Are there events? Yes, I'm actually in March. I'm traveling to Atlanta to go to the Huthmaker Violin Shop's exhibit of work of women luthiers.
Awesome.
Yes, it'll be really cool. And then I will be going to Georgia again, actually in June, for the Viola Society's biannual viola festival. So I'll be there with my work and showing some violas. Those are the upcoming things.
So listeners in Atlanta.
yes, they can get a full dose of me. Two doses.
Awesome. And if you enjoyed listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button wherever you're tuning into this podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. It doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of the crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day, and it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Haydn Behind the Music Stand family by donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/HaydnMusicStand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is at Haydn Music Stand. And we'd love to hear from you at our email, haydnmusicstand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize a piece we discussed during the episode? No worries. There's a Spotify playlist with all the music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the description of each episode. Thank you so much, Ute, for joining me on the show today.
It was so much fun.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, I'm always rushing to you to say, help, something's wrong. Or, I think there's something wrong. And then you're like, yes, you actually have a severe open seam. And I'm like, wait, what? Anyway, so it's just wonderful to spend some time, sit down and talk without the instrument.
Without the panic.
Thanks for listening. Sushi, say bye.